Messy Realities, the secret life of technology.
Hello, my name's Gemma Hughes. I'm a health services researcher at Oxford University, and I, with my colleagues and friends, have put together this podcast series called Messy Realities, the secret life of technology. The series describes how we took our research into assisted living technologies to the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford in search of some new meaning and inspiration. In this episode, we go backstage in the museum to discuss themes of ageing and conservation. I talked to Jem and Andrew, conservators at the Pitt Rivers, Josie, who's Public Engagement and Research Officer at the Pitt Rivers Museum, and Caitlin, who's a medical anthropologist who's been undertaking her doctoral research into living well at the end of life as part of the SCALS research programme. That's the Studies in Co-Created Assisted Living Solutions. So welcome, everyone. Josie, when we came into the conservation lab the first time, before we did that, you took us into the museum to look at some particular exhibits that you'd picked out as relevant to the theme of progression that we'd identified from our research. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the exhibits that you thought we'd be interested in looking at?
Yeah, definitely. So we were accessing the idea of progression from almost like a medical perspective. So we were trying to think about progression as the journey towards end of life, potentially. So we looked at objects in the collection which might relate to that theme and journey in some way. And one of the most obvious parts of the collection for me was the Malagan material from Papua New Guinea. So there's lots of objects in the museum which are here for very complex reasons. One of the notable things I think about the Malangan is that they represent objects that weren't necessarily made by the originating community to last. So in the museum, objects are often taken out of their context and they're kept alive in some ways artificially through conservation, through curatorial interventions. But in their original context, many of these objects were made to ultimately disappear or disintegrate or go back into the land in which they were created from. So the Malangan are very complex items, but they represent very complex beliefs in cosmological and spiritual systems in Papua New Guinea. And simply, the Malangan are made to disappear. They're used in ritual situations, and then they're left to go back into the forest landscape that they came from. So we looked at those objects and talked about the idea and the ethics around keeping objects going in a museum setting. And then we went into the lab, which had really interesting parallels to and questions around the ethics of keeping things going, really.
So the Malangan are we handled one of those, didn't we? It looked like a wooden bird to me.
Yeah.
I know we've talked in other episodes of this podcast series about how objects have multiple meanings.
Mm-hmm.
But this was an object that we handled. It was an object that was quite attractive, quite appealing.
Mm-hmm.
But it has had, and the objects, the Malangan on display, have got lots of complex meanings associated with them. But the reason we chose to look at them was to pick up our theme around progression and our concern that as people progress in their illnesses or their as they age, they require different kinds of help and support from the technologies that have been designed for them.
And the handling object which you mentioned, it's a boat prow, it's a replica boat prow, and it's had lots of conservation interventions because it's been dropped a few times because it's a handling collection item and it is a piece of tourist art.
It's
an example that was collected from the tourist trade, and I remember the beak snapping off at least once or twice. So definitely Andrew and Jem have seen this very proud. But it was really lovely to be able to pass this object around while we were talking about the main collection items in the museum and start that discussion around progression and personalisation and how people can intervene in a meaningful way in the progression towards the end of an object's life or a person's life, and how that can be brought back to the individual.
So perhaps if we start with you, Jem, can you tell us a little bit about what you do in the museum, what your work involves?
I suppose our work mainly involves looking after the collections in various ways. So we can do that sort of passively by controlling the environment and light levels, thinking about the way that objects respond to changes in humidity, for example, and trying to limit those to stop objects becoming damaged. Or we can do it actively by actually interventive treatments onto objects, consolidating paint, sticking missing pieces back on, actual physical interventions. I suppose here at the Pitt Rivers, we're quite aware that objects are complex and have a lot of meanings to a lot of people. And so when we actively work on objects, we try and do as little as possible to them to achieve what we need to achieve, but using the minimum amount of intervention possible. Mm-hmm. So this kind of more passive intervention also includes teaching people how to handle objects properly, making sure that objects are stored in the best way possible, making sure that objects are supported when they're on display so that fragile pieces are supported by the mount. So it's really about thinking about objects in the various ways that we work to preserve their life in the museum for as long as possible.
So to me, that sounds like a very careful appreciation of preserving an object in the right way. The example of the handling object is a great one, where it gets dropped and broken, which is really, I know this particular object is a piece of tourist art, but you've got that real tension there. If you want something to be used and useful and people to interact with it, but then they go and break the thing, I mean, that's the last thing you want. So there's a real tension there, I guess, in terms of allowing people to touch and handle things.
I think sometimes there can be a tension. Sometimes the objects are very fragile and we know that damage is going to happen if they're handled. Quite often the people who handle objects are from the community who made them, and so they're incredibly careful. They don't want to break objects. Mm. They don't see it as, it would be a terrible thing to break something made by your ancestor. So they are incredibly careful. Mm. And in fact, we've never really had problems with anything being handled. The only breakages we've had are on previous conservation repairs. I suppose that's the difference between repairing something for the handling collection and repairing an object from the museum collections, is that for the handling collection, we might stick something wooden back together with epoxy just to make sure it can be handled and is not going to break again. Whereas with the museum collection, we would use a much weaker adhesive so that the joint would break and not damage the original material further. I think there are tensions, but I think just by teaching people about where an object is fragile and how it can be handled properly, then we can kind of minimize those tensions. And I think here at the Pitt Rivers, we try and be more open than maybe some other institutions in letting people handle objects and trying to make them as accessible as possible.
And I think people are really, when we do give the opportunity to people to hold handle objects, again talking about the handling collection, that they're again quite reverent of material, so people don't expect coming to the museum like the Pitt Rivers and get to actually embody the material. So it's quite amazing often for me how our public participants might have more careful objects in the handling collection than some of our colleagues who get slightly desensitised with the handling collection. We're using it so often. It's interesting to give it to the public, and they often are much more careful and reverent than we can be with our handling collection, which is a lesson for all of us.
I love listening to you talk about your work, and I keep drawing parallels with some of your work, Caitlin, in terms of preserving people, I guess, and doing so in a way, when you talk about passively and actively conserving, it makes me think about non-invasive procedures, medical procedures, and how best to provide the right kind of care for somebody who is perhaps very frail and isn't robust enough to have a curative procedure, for example, but might require some palliative support, I guess. That's what I can't stop myself thinking about those issues, Caitlin. Does that resonate with your research?
Yeah, partly. I think this interesting kind of thing the Pitt Rivers does, letting members of the public handle objects versus just view them behind glass, that kind of makes me think about, I drew a distinction between movement and stillness in my research. So towards the end of life, we're often telling our loved ones, in order to keep them safe, if they are frail, if they are finding it difficult to do things, sit still, like stay there and you'll be safe. You won't break. Mm-hmm. But for me, part of the critique of that is saying, how far is that a life worth living? Mm-hmm. How far is being still actually involving yourself in living? And it's kind of a similar, maybe, idea about objects that sit in a museum and are viewed, which might be Like if you think about like an art exhibition of kind of visual art, then maybe that is what they're for. Maybe that is their life that they're living. If you think about objects having lives. But if things are meant to be used and you're meant to engage with them sensorially, if you're meant to touch them and feel them and weigh them and do that, maybe that's a more honest, I don't know, interaction and human object interaction. Kind of that's what it made me think of.
Yeah, I mean the idea that you tell people not to do stuff in order to preserve them is one that I certainly found in my research, a kind of a fall's risk assessment. So somebody, if an older person is at risk of falling over, they might well have a fall's risk assessment. And someone comes around to their house and sort of says things like, well, those slippers are a bit sloppy and that mat needs nailing down and you need to stop going outside in the backyard. And the person is saying, well, I'm not going to stop going outside in my backyard. I want to continue to live my life. But yeah. It's this kind of risk benefit kind of
discussion. and that kind of trade-off, which I don't like, that kind of that idea of like you've got this quantifiable trade-off that you can make, but those lived decisions, those decisions we make every single day as we go about our daily lives, they often look quite different from the person actually living their life to the person looking at it from the outside. Because if like a lot of my participants said, like, I couldn't sit in the same chair every day, it would drive me insane and I wouldn't want to be alive. So what's the point if I do keep myself safe? You know, so it kind of made me think, as you were talking, Jim, kind of, are objects kind of made to be broken sometimes? Not quite in the same way, but kind of, are they made to be handled? Are the breakages part of their life cycle? In a kind of meaningful way. Obviously, this is a museum and, like, you know, we are trying to preserve things and conserve things, and it's interesting tension, maybe.
Mm. Andrew, what are you working on at the moment? What kinds of artefacts are you working to conserve at the moment?
It's kind of a tricky question to answer, really, because the answer is kind of everything. Here we don't really have... in some museums, conservators will have a... object specialism or material specialism, which they'll work with. So, for example, paintings or ceramics. Most of our objects in the museum are made from a wide range of composite materials. And we sort of general conservators who have to be aware of sort of how different materials react with each other, how different materials age, how they age differently, how things can be, I suppose, quite unique. So one treatment for one object can be, it's very unique treatment.
What's the right word?
So I don't know whether it, the thing that you're making me think about and the connection I would make in health is this idea of people having multi-morbidities, where they have not just one health problem or one diagnosis, but they have many things wrong with them. And you might prescribe a medication that might help their heart failure, but that might also then damage something else in their body. And you have an interaction of the multiple medications in a person which have to be managed very carefully. So it's, you know, your treatment for one thing might trigger off a disturbance somewhere else. So it's quite a complex, you end up with a very complex process going on within one individual. Is that a similar analogy, or am I pushing that a bit far?
I don't know. I think you might be pushing it a bit farther. Well, from a logic point of view, I suppose, I think that one thing which is maybe a similar analogy is the fact that a lot of the times the biggest problems that we have are where I think we're dealing with old treatments that have happened in the past, which have sort of used materials which have not aged well. So something might have been glued together in the past with something which was great at the time, and then 50 years down the line, it's no longer really working as a glue, and it's gone hard, and it's soaked into the material. And so it's not really doing the job that it was intended to the first time. And so I think those are some of our most complex treatments, are having to work with those other interventions which have happened in the past. And I suppose that's part of our job as well, is looking at the physical condition of objects and seeing, like, reading the the physical condition to sort of figure out sort of a story about what's happened to it in this past when it comes to like damage or something. Mm-hmm. So you might be able to figure out that, you know, this was banged here, it was dropped, this bit snapped, somebody glued it back together again, this mm-hmm. bit's been in the sunlight for ages and it's a completely different color to what it was originally. And trying to figure out how was that history and what is the what you can do to try and help facilitate handling and getting the most out of that object in the future without causing that same problem again 50 years down the line, I suppose.
Is there a sense that a lot of what you do has to be reversible?
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the, you know, leading concepts of conservation is that things have to be retreatable. So we aim that, you know, most of the things that we do can be taken away to leave the object as it was before. Mm. I mean, obviously there are some things that we do that aren't. For example, if we have some powdery pigment on an object and we consolidate it, there's no practical way in which you can reverse that treatment. Mm. But yeah, ideally everything we do would be retreatable.
Are there any particular interventions from the past that you had to deal with that you just thought, why was that intervention done? Are there any examples of specific?
You do wonder why people use sellotape on museum objects.
Really?
Yeah, and sellotape ages really badly, so it yellows and brittles and it's really hard to get off. So yeah, spent many hours in the past trying to remove sellotape residues from objects.
I think most of the time when you, I think the world of conservation is something which is ever trying to improve itself and come up with new materials to use, new, more reversible, maintain like the qualities of like an adhesive, but you'll be able to reverse it for much longer. So I think when you look at these things, part of you is like going, why did they do that? But at the same time, you can kind of understand that we're looking at something which happened, you know, when the latest technology wasn't available. Yeah. Well, today's technology wasn't available.
Yeah, so most of the time, I think people were doing what they genuinely thought was best at the time, even if we now know that that wasn't the case.
And if objects have gone through like several iterations of like the way they looked or the way that they worked, how do you decide what phase to put it back to? I mean, I don't know if there are particular examples that you guys could draw on.
I suppose that's, I suppose it's something which we try, because we have a very minimal intervention when we're treating objects. That's something which we, it's a really, really difficult question to answer. And probably what we're trying to do is just make that object stable, stable enough that you can handle it, that you can get the most information from it. So I suppose, you know, one example are things which are really badly faded. We have a lot of textiles in the collection. The museum used to have a glass roof, and so you quite often find textiles which were on display and have been bleached by the sun, and one side of them will have lost a lot of colour, but you turn it over and you can see what the original colours were like. We wouldn't be trying to return that colour to the faded side, I mean, mainly because, again, I suppose what we're doing as well, we're always thinking about the future and how our treatments are going to age in the future. So you could probably apply colours to, you know, re-dye a surface. I mean, that's not really, it's not really possible, but let's pretend. But then you've got to think, you know, that what's that going to look like in 50 years' time? Sure. You know, everything's going to age in different ways. So. Yeah, it's not really something which we try to do here.
I think one of the things that the group found really interesting when we brought the community group and our research partners into the lab the first time, I think one of you talked about why you wear gloves, and I think I always presumed before I worked in a museum that gloves are worn to protect the object from us, but maybe you can say a bit about the really interesting, terrifying information as to why you wear gloves.
Well, we've always known that museum collections have been treated with pesticides ever since about 1820, when arsenic was first used. Some recent research that we've carried out here looking at the Cook Voyage collections has shown that our objects are contaminated with lead and mercury and arsenic and virtually every kind of pesticide that you can imagine, including quite nasty organophosphate like dieldrin and lindane. So while gloves do protect objects from sweat, and you know, if you touch a metal object without gloves, you can etch your fingerprints into the surface. Quite a lot of it is to do with actually protecting people from the objects. And that's another reason why handling might be restricted.
Yeah.
Just because we don't currently know how much of that residue is transferable onto people's hands, you know, how much if they touch their face or, you know, rub their eye, how much might actually get into their body. So yeah, there are quite a few undesirable contaminants on our collections.
That's a really interesting perspective on it that I would never have really thought about. I mean, we talked before about how pests are a problem. Moths in particular, I understand, are a problem in the museum. So you tell us a bit about how you deal with those. I know it's a perennial problem.
There are a couple of moths which you may have in your homes. So clothes moths generally, which will like to eat sort of proteinaceous material, so feathers and fur and wool. And unfortunately, lots of our collection does a lot of wool textiles. Things are decorated with feathers and fur all the time. And that's sort of the reason why there is this history of applying pesticides to the collection. That kind of came out of fashion after sort of EU regulations came into play, banning use of pesticides. So things which are more recently come into the collections sometimes suffer from being attacked by moths more than things which have been in the collection for a long time and have sort of residual pesticide on. But they can cause a huge amount of damage to the objects because for the same reason before, we don't really want to be applying pesticides to collections which might want to be handled in the future. And because there's a lot of staff work with the collections as well, generally we'll have to treat it by freezing the objects. So they get frozen at minus 30 degrees for about three days, which sort of kills all the moths and their larvae and their eggs as well. But they come out of the freezer, we clean them, and then they're put straight back into the museum where, you know, we could put it in the museum and a moth goes and lands on it and lays some eggs straight away, really. So it's a little bit of a continual battle of monitoring, continually monitoring the whole of the museum environment to see if we can spot any pest problems early.
I've never thought of something such a typical mundane household problem of clothes moths is affecting the museum. So it's really interesting. Of course it does.
And they're now living in the fabric of the building. They're not just living on the collection. Yeah. So all of the voids under cases that we can't access, all of the places that we can't clean, which is why we kind of have this residual population which remains no matter what we do.
So it's a case of managing it rather than eradicating the problem.
I think we are doing better than we have since records are moth records began, so we're at quite a good point at the moment, but yeah, it would be nice to eradicate them, but I don't think that's possible in our historic interior.
Well, there's a tension there with the way that the museum is. I mean, we were talking earlier about in another podcast about how the Pitt Rivers Museum is not this kind of sterile, sanctified space. It is actually full of things, and that brings its own problems with it, doesn't it? One of the things that we looked at, Josie, when we were thinking about this theme, and it speaks to some of the things you've talked about breakages, is we looked at some of the kintsugi objects that are in the museum. Can you explain to us, Josie, what those objects are and how they have been made?
Yeah, so Jem and Andrew actually curated an exhibition on Kintsugi 2 years ago, so you'll probably be able to give more context, but we had, again, a couple of handling items that we looked at in, with our community partners in the gallery space alongside examples of objects that, which have been broken and mended. But Kintsugi is really simply often quite valuable items of chinaware, usually, that have been broken and put back together using, I think it's lead gem, but covered, traditionally lead, but covered with gold.
Is it's that right? Urushi lacquer.
Okay. I might gem you. But just to say, our community partners were really fascinated by Kintsugi, particularly because, as Gem will explain, the breakages in themselves imbue the object with more value. Mm-hmm. So although an object is broken, it becomes monetarily more valuable because of the gold rishi lacquer. But also the lacquer work almost embeds within the object the worth of it to the owner. So,
yes. Yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily a high value object, it's about monetarily, but it's more about sentimental value, really. So, you know, your favourite tea bowl, if that got broken, you might pay for it to have a Kintsugi repair, which kind of shows its status and its value to you as an object rather than monetarily. So we had a small exhibition here at the Pitt Rivers on Indigenous repairs, so repairs that had happened to objects while they were being used, and some of those have been quite highly decorated. There was a gourd, for example, which had a split which had been sewn up, meticulously drilled holes on either side of the break and sewn that break together and put coloured beads in the break, kind of highlighting and emphasising the repair, to try and make people think about why objects are valued. You know, obviously, if you have an ivory bracelet and it breaks, you're probably going to want to repair that. But why repair a gourd, for example? You know, quite common, quite cheap. And then we actually bought two Kintsugi artists from Japan to do some workshops in the museum. They made one of the pieces in the handling collection together with the Anagama kiln, which is also an Oxford University project in Whiteham Woods. So the pot in the handling collection and the two that were accessioned into our collection were made by a Japanese master potter, a living national treasure, who came over to work with the Anagama kiln at Whiteham and then smashed some pots purposefully so that the Kintsugi artist could Kintsugi them, which isn't quite in the spirit of Kintsugi, but was quite interesting nonetheless.
Yeah.
But also as part of that, some of our friends, we offered them the opportunity to have objects which were meaningful to them to be worked on by the craftsmen, mm-hmm. And to tell the stories about those objects and why they were meaningful and, you know, why they wanted them to be repaired.
Mm-hmm.
It is about, you know, value.
And I think one of the friends of the Pitt Rivers Museum, I think one of them, was it a plate that they brought in that was, I think it was Star Wars or something, really bizarre. You didn't expect this person to have, but they brought in a very specific Star Wars plate that was fixed.
With Kintsugi.
With Kintsugi,
A lot of the people who brought in their plates actually, you know, they remember the time and the occasion and who broke it and when it broke. You know, it's often like a child, one of the children.
So it really helped you see the layers of value, like a personal and social value that objects accrue, and the Kintsugi, it's really just kind of solidifies that, actually.
When we had our workshops, I think there were kind of two strands of discussion that came out of the Kintsugi. One was around how we make, amend and repair things and why we do, which very much speaks to what you've been talking about. And we had a bit of a discussion about the skills that you need to mend things. And we talked about clothing, actually, and how there's sometimes a bit of a throwaway culture of cheap clothing as opposed to the desire to mend things and they become more meaningful as you mend them. Although we talked about how if you're mending clothing, you often want the mend to be invisible rather than visible. So there were some interesting parallels there. But it also prompted us to think about aging and how we value people as they get older and they bear more scars, or we all, you know, we learn more, we become perhaps stronger through the things we've learned. We had some quite profound conversations really about what it means to no longer be perfect, I guess. Which I don't know, Caitlin, whether that brings any reflections from your research. You did quite a lot of research with people who were really quite unwell towards the end of their lives, and you know, looking back perhaps at their past events and how they've become who they are. Is there anything that kind of resonates with your research from this?
Yeah.
These thoughts.
Yeah. So a lot of my thesis was inspired by a very particular anthropological understanding of making, and making not only as an artistic endeavor and a creative kind of tangible endeavor of making physical objects, but also making your life worth living and remaking and unmaking the things that you do every day that might no longer work for you. So, I mean, a lot of what you've been saying about mending and making those mends visible is kind of what I see my participants having done in their own lives. And the way that certain things get left behind, not because they're broken, but because they can't be unmade, they can't be broken. And remade in a way that is useful. So I can't think of a good example now, but I ended up drawing, I drew a lot of my thinking for all of this because I couldn't write it down at first. So I ended up drawing what I saw, which was participants who ended up really quite unwell towards the end of life, kind of, you know, maybe a few weeks away. They'd be sitting often in a chair, kind of, probably in an armchair that had something adapted so that they could sit in it more comfortably, and they'd be kind of in one room and they would stay in that one room. And as you walked throughout the house or looked in that one room, there were kind of these concentric circles of stuff that they left behind that was no longer useful to them. So, you know, the phone maybe would be quite close to them, but their Zimmer frame would be kind of towards the periphery of the room. And then you'd go into another room in the house and you'd find their diary, or you'd find like a different kind of pairs of shoes or something, things that were no longer useful to them. And I suppose, yeah, I was just really fascinated by this idea of having to unmake your life when it changes, and unmake the way that you do things and remake them. Yeah, so that was kind of my thought about that.
The when you were talking earlier, Andrew, about trying to trace the history of what had happened when previous conservation attempts had been made with an object, that made me think about the idea of objects having biographies and stories. And you talked about the museum used to have a glass roof, and that was one of the things that some of our participants picked up on, the kind of story of the museum as an object, but also the stories that are associated with objects. Do you want to say a little bit about that, Josie?
Yeah, we often think about objects as having biographies. It's a very anthropological approach, but also it'd be useful for the museum to think through objects. So we recognise that objects have life stages. It's probably worth also thinking through that the term object is not always appropriate for what we are now calling objects. So lots of material in the collection would be better understood as ancestors or living material. So we're using the term object and artefact as a kind of easy phrase. But the objects in the collection are animate for many people, whether or not you come from the culture that it made the object. The objects within the museum have a huge amount of meaning for people. And I think it's useful to think about life stages. So we talked a little bit in the workshops around maybe the initial life stage being within the community that made that object, and that object being used, put into use, and then a next stage of the object's life that might be when it's collected into the museum collection. And obviously the life of that object will then change quite dramatically. So when the object moves from its place of origin into the museum, again, if you're thinking about the object as quite sentient, its whole surroundings have changed, it's removed from its original context. And then we were looking at the workshops themselves as a separate life stage where the objects are being reanimated from different perspectives. So yeah, when we talk about object biographies, it's a really useful way to think about the material as more than just a static thing, but something of use, something that's embodied, can be continually, and that potentially has an end point, like all lives do.
Mm-hmm. The final sort of point that I wondered if we might want to talk about a little bit more is around the ethics of some of this work, because we are used, I think, in as researchers researching with human subjects, as we refer to our research participants, we're used to being very having to be very thoughtful around our ethical approach towards people, and we are also very aware of, as people are moving towards the end of their lives, some of the ethics around not only engaging those people in research, but in terms of those people being engaged in different kinds of therapies or medications or treatment regimes. But I've certainly, as someone who's not knowledgeable about material objects, never really thought about the ethics of working with some of the things, the objects, the artifacts in the museum. So we've sort of touched on the issue of ethics and conservation of museum artifacts, but can you say a little bit more about the kind of ethical framework that you have to consider as you're doing your restorations, or indeed as you're thinking about working with different community groups?
Maybe if I start from the perspective that I'm coming from, which is very much about community engagement and research engagement. So this was when Gemma first came to us to talk about the possibilities of doing a project which became Messy Realities. We did think quite long and hard about the ethics around bringing material from global material into conversation with very local community groups and whether that is the right approach. So there's some arguments that
we're a bit concerned about the kind of exoticization of the objects.
So, exoticization. And also, is it ethical to layer new meanings over objects when that narrative isn't coming from the original community, but it's coming from an octogenarian living in Cowley, or you know, or people who have no cultural connection to that object apart from the museum itself and the museum being a meeting point. So it was a question that we always think through. So a lot of the work we do here is connecting local groups and individuals with the collection, and it is a global collection. So that's always something that we think through. All the material that we chose to look at in the context of Messy Realities we felt was appropriate, and it was ethically okay to have local community groups reframe those objects. I think at the forefront of what we've been trying to do is always be very transparent about the new narratives that are being developed around objects by our community partners and our research partners and us ourselves as museum facilitators. Isn't the truth of that object, it isn't the defining narrative about that object, but it is a response to that object, and that's an approach that we're very happy to champion, because as a museum, we feel that the objects need to be in use. Caitlin, as you were talking about, do objects and people, does their life end when they're not being used? And that's something we're always thinking through as well. So yes, it was a big kind of ethical consideration, but I think the value, the richness of the conversations and ideas about objects that came out of the workshops made us very confident in this approach. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk more about?
Well, I suppose in conservation, we kind of have different levels of ethics. I mean, as conservators, we kind of sign up to various, you know, lists of ethical considerations that we need to think about before we actually work on an object. And they're to do with things like retreatability and documenting what we do fully, so that people in the future know what we've done and can undo it if possible. But I suppose in an ethnographic museum, we as conservators are more aware that everything we work on is meaningful to someone. And I suppose that it really came home to me when I was working in New Zealand in Auckland Museum, and one of the Maori directors came in with a piece of a Maori meeting house carved in the shape of a figure and said, "This is being treated for an exhibition. It's my grandfather, you know, look after my grandfather," because it depicted one of his ancestors, and he wanted to know everything that we were going to do, you know, every kind of treatment that we might use on it. And I suppose that really brought home the fact that, you know, objects really do have meaning, and, you know, far more meaning than we might realise. So in terms of what we do in conservation, I suppose we try and be as do as little intervention as possible. But where we do want to do something more interventive, we will try and find out from the community whether they would actually want us to proceed with that. And quite often when we do more interventive things, in partnership with a project that involves members of a community anyway. For example, when we worked on the Blackfoot shirts a few years ago, when they were going back on loan to Canada, we were able to talk to Blackfoot elders about how they wanted their shirts represented. You know, these are sacred objects in Blackfoot culture because they have human hair on them. He was able to bless us before we worked on them. You know, we said to him, you know, how clean should we make them? You know, we can clean them. How clean should they be? And he basically said, you know, we want to be represented in the best possible light, so make them clean. So also, you know, where we want, might want to take samples and do analysis and destructive analysis. I'm thinking about the Cook Voyage collections at the moment where we did analysis on resins. We actually contacted Maori researchers and asked to say, do you think this is a good idea? Should we be doing it in a different way? You know, and basically we kind of took on board what they said to us and, you know, made sure that we share the results widely with, you know, scholars and Maori groups and disseminated our research. So I think we really do think about ethics and who we're actually doing things for. And who actually is a stakeholder in, you know, conservation treatments or analysis or, you know, anything else that we might do with objects.
So it sounds as if not only do you take a lot of care to talk to people and engage with people for whom those particular bits of work or conservation are relevant, but you're very open to accepting different understandings of what those objects actually are, not just what they represent, but what they actually are.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you accept that those objects are different things for different peoples. And that's very much part of your approach. That sounds correct.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, even the... we're working on a project at the moment where we're looking at 3D replicas of musical instruments. And, you know, we quite often get asked to play our historic musical instruments. They are really dry and really fragile and also covered in pesticides. So it's probably not a good idea. But, you know, people often say, well, make a 3D replica. Mm. It'll be exactly the same. But no one's ever really kind of made a 3D replica to see if it sounds the same.
Mm.
So we're doing a project at the moment with an ivory recorder from 1720 as our playable instrument so that we can compare the 3D printouts with an original. As part of that, we may 3D print a Maori bone flute and ask Maori artists to play it. But before we can print that flute out, we want to get some advice on whether it's something that we should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a lot of Maori consider that every time you print out an object, the manner, the kind of sacred significance of the original diminishes. They want to know what we're going to do with the files. You know, we can't just put them on our website for everyone to print a Maori flute. So there are quite a lot of things to consider.
That's a brilliant point on which to wrap up this conversation, because you've got a wonderful example there of how a new technology actually potentially changes, even damages an existing artifact or technology or object or people. So that's a brilliant example of a really interesting but quite fraught project. And I guess if that's a project that people are interested in finding out more about, they can come to the Pitt Rivers and learn about that 3D printing.
Yeah,
project.
We're hoping there'll be an exhibition at some point. And we also have a project website where people can learn about the problems of having a ivory recorder 3D printed.
Fantastic. So that's the Pitt Rivers website they can find that on. That's brilliant. So I'm going to finish by saying thank you very much to Jem, to Andrew, to Caitlin and to Josie for joining me in conversation about themes of progression, aging, conservation, and thank you for bearing with me in making sometimes some rather tenuous connections between your work and our research, but nonetheless very interesting points, I think. If people want to hear more about the conversations that have inspired our discussions here today, then you can listen to some of the other episodes in the podcast series. Thank you very much.